Good afternoon. We're going to begin. Thank you all for joining us today. I'm Steve Morrison. I direct the Africa program here at CSIS, as well as a task force on HIV/AIDS, a center-wide task force. I'd invite everyone who is here, who cares to please come and join us at the square. There's plenty of open seating here. We decided to host this event a few weeks back when Ambassador John Lang, to my left, who is the administration's special representative on avian and pandemic influenza, called and brought to our attention that the first ever Africa-based international conference on avian and human pandemic influenza was going to be held in early December. And that this was going to offer us a very good moment to take a snapshot and an update on where the global response stands. This is a session which is a ministerial level. It's one at which a lot of data is exchanged and a lot of pledging activity unfolds. And so we took up John's offer and. And he, on his side, was kind enough to enlist two other members of the U.S. delegation that was in Bamako, Dr. Ken Hill, who's a good friend of CSIS. He's the Assistant Administrator, Bureau of Global Health at USAID, has been very, very active on a number of global health issues, and we're delighted that he's with us here today. John also enlisted Dr. Ron DeHaven, administrator for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services, to be with us. And just this morning, we were delighted to learn that David Nabarro is also available and able to come and join us today. David, to any of you who have worked this issue or observed the evolution of the issue, he is the UN System Center Coordinator for Avian and Human Influenza. He's been in that position now since September of 2005. He's arguably the linchpin of most of the global coordinating efforts. He's indefatigable, and it's a major boon, I think, for us today to have John, his team, as well as David here with us. What we're going to do this afternoon is ask Ambassador Lang to open up with observations and remarks around the outcome of the Bamako gathering, and then we'll move to David, and then we'll ask Kent and Ron to add their remarks. We'll then open the floor for comments and questions, and come back to our panelists. So again, thank you all for joining, and John, David, Kent, and Ron, thank you for being with us today. John, do you want to kick things off?
Thank you very much, Steve, and thanks to the Center for Strategic and International Studies for organizing this event today. We very much appreciate it and look forward to an exchange of ideas in the question and answer session. As an indication of the broad international effort that the U.S. government is undertaking internationally on the issue of avian influenza and the preparing for a possible pandemic, we had four federal departments and agencies represented on the U.S. delegation in Bamako December 6th and 8th. You have with us, as you heard, Dr. Kent Hill from USAID and Dr. Ron DeHaven from USDA, the Department of Agriculture. We also had on our delegation Dr. David Bell from the Department of Health and Human Services. He's the head of their International Influenza Unit. Regrettably, he's unable to be with us here today. But we had those three agencies and departments, as well as the Department of State. And in the Department of State, the way we are organized is we have something called the Avian Influenza Action Group that I head, and I work directly for the Undersecretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs, Paula Dobrianski. So we have organized ourselves as a government federally to deal with this issue, avian and pandemic influenza internationally. Before I go into the specifics of Bamako and the results of that conference, I thought it would be useful just to give you a sense of the threat that we face from this highly pathogenic H5N1 virus. As many of you know, it first appeared in Hong Kong in 1997, reappeared in Southeast Asia in 2003. And if you just look at what has happened in 2006, it's been really a dramatic increase. It was present in 14 countries at the start of this year. It's now present in 55 countries. According to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, over 2 million poultry have died or been culled to contain this spread among poultry populations. Poultry losses and concomitant losses in egg production have deprived populations of a major source of protein and income, and this clearly has an impact on developing countries which have fragile food systems. On the human health side, the World Health Organization reports that over 250 humans have been infected, which is not a large number considering the hundreds of millions of birds that have become infected, but of those 250 plus, over 150 have died. To date, however, and this is an important factor for everyone to keep in mind, there has been no mutation or reassortment that would result in sustained and efficient human-to-human transmission. And that is really the indicator of an incipient global pandemic. And we have not had that sustained and efficient transmission. But the United States government and governments around the world and the UN system and others are preparing for that possibility in case there ever was such a mutation. And if you look at that and take the worst-case scenario, that of the 1918 pandemic, one estimate for today's figures is that 142 million people could die around the world, possibly 1.9 million in the United States alone. The World Bank has estimated that a severe pandemic among humans could cost the global economy about 3.1% of gross domestic product. That's about $1.25 trillion. The focus here today is on the international engagement of the United States government, the United Nations, and countries around the world, and how we're dealing with this issue. And as many of you know, in September of 2005, President Bush announced at the United Nations General Assembly the International Partnership on Avian and Pandemic Influenza. And the first meeting was held in Washington in October of 2005. The goal of that international partnership is to elevate this issue on national agendas, coordinate efforts among donor and affected nations, mobilize and leverage resources, increase transparency and the quality of surveillance, and build long-term capacity to identify, contain, and respond in both animal and human health sectors. And that concept of long-term capacity is something that we constantly keep in mind as we focus our assistance, because we do not know if this will ever result in a global pandemic, but these preparations should have a long-term impact. And if you look in our implementation plan, you will find that it really describes our efforts to deal with an influenza with pandemic potential. The implementation plan is not geared strictly to the H5N1 highly pathogenic virus. It has broader capabilities and applicability. Now, our international engagement is a key element, but certainly not the only element, in our national strategy for pandemic influenza and the implementation plan. And many of you have seen this document, 227 pages, and this is our guiding document for what we're doing, the National Strategy for Pandemic Influenza Implementation Plan. Some of you may be aware that there was an event earlier today at which Francis Fragos Townsend, who is the assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, summarized the progress that has been made in implementing the actions in this implementation plan during the first 6 months since it was released. The national strategy was released on November 1, 2005, by the President, and on that day he requested $7.1 billion from Congress to accomplish the objectives of the strategy. The implementation plan then was released on May 3rd, and it directs federal departments and agencies to undertake over 300 actions in support of the national strategy. Our strategy is based in broad respects on three pillars: preparedness and communication, surveillance and detection, and response and containment. Now, there's another important framework that people should keep aware of for our global influenza activities, and that is the revised International Health Regulations, known as the IHRs. These will come into force in June of 2007, and on December 13th of this year, Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mike Leavitt, announced the U.S. government's formal acceptance of the IHRs and our decision to comply on a voluntary basis with their provisions between now and the time they take legal effect. In our international efforts, we support the work and work very closely with the UN System Influenza Coordinator, Dr. David Nabarro, and I'm delighted that he's with us here today. And we also work very closely with other key international organizations, the World Health Organization on the human health side, the Food and Agriculture Organization on the animal health side, UNICEF, which is charged with dealing with communications on this issue, and an organization that is not connected officially with the UN but cooperates closely with FAO, the World Organization for Animal Health, known by its French initials as OIE, based in Paris. Since that first meeting of the International Partnership in Washington in October of 2005, there have been meetings in Beijing, China, January of this year, Vienna, Austria in June of this year, and then December 6th, 7th, and 8th in Bamako. The Bamako ministerial-level conference was organized by the government of Mali, the African Union, and the European Commission, and it served to highlight the issue globally. It was really a global conference, but there was a particular focus on the emerging situation in Africa. As many of you know, that continent first encountered avian influenza in Nigeria in February of this year, which was after the Beijing conference that had been a pledging conference in January. And a very small percentage of the funds pledged by donor governments and the World Bank and others in January was devoted to Africa. In the Bamako meeting, nearly 80 countries were represented. The discussion made clear that much progress has been achieved in the last year, but that much more needs to be done. The delegates expressed particular concern about the expansion of the disease in poultry in three countries, Indonesia, Egypt, and Nigeria. But there was concern for many other countries in addition to those, but there was particular concern for those three countries. On planning for a possible pandemic, the WHO representative said that global surveillance has improved, but there still are many blind spots. The World Bank, UNICEF, and others described new studies and strategies on compensation and culling of poultry and on communications and public awareness activities. In its intervention on behalf of non-governmental organizations, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies stressed that community-based organizations and civil society play a unique and complementary role and have to work cooperatively to mitigate the risks and the challenges. In the end, being an international conference, there was a Bamako Declaration, and the Bamako Declaration that was approved by the delegates called on all countries to follow such core principles as transparency in reporting influenza cases and the immediate sharing of epidemiological data and samples to detect and characterize the nature and the evolution of any outbreaks as quickly as possible in order to achieve early containment. Finally, the last day of the conference was a pledging session that resulted in a major infusion of new resources. In Beijing, in January of this year, donors had pledged $1.9 billion. In Bamako, 10 days ago, donor governments pledged almost $500 million more to this international effort. The United States government led in terms of pledges with a pledge of $100 million over the amount that we had pledged in Beijing, bringing our new total to $434 million for the international assistance. And the global total now comes to $2.35 billion. This deals both with the avian influenza outbreaks that have been occurring, as I said, in 55 nations, and in planning for a possible human pandemic. In terms of next steps, the nations of the world still have a daunting task ahead. To take further action to contain avian influenza outbreaks in affected countries and to strengthen pandemic readiness globally. The international community will take stock of the progress that we make at the next high-level conference. That's going to be a meeting of the International Partnership on Avian and Pandemic Influenza in New Delhi, India, during the last quarter of 2007. But there is much to be done in the meantime, and we'll hear a bit more of that from Dr. Navarro in terms of the UN's plans in this regard. We in the United States government are urging other nations around the world to comply now with the provisions of the revised international health regulations, which call for this transparency and other important factors, before those regulations enter into force next year. We'll be distributing here a fact sheet on the U.S. Government's international engagement, and I'd be happy to discuss our work further. If for those of you who are interested, for more information both on the domestic efforts on the part of the U.S. government and our international efforts, you may wish to look at the catch-all U.S. government website. It's called www.pandemicflu.gov. www.pandemicflu.gov. There's also a website specific to the State Department's efforts in this regard and the international side, which is www.state.gov/g/avianflu. So with that, I would hope we would now be able to hear from the others to get their perspectives on the nature of this threat. The international commitments of the United States as well as the United Nations, and observations from the Bamako Conference. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you, John. David.
Well, thank you, Stephen, for the chance to be here. It's very good indeed to be at this CSIS event. You and I have corresponded a lot about participation in such things. Here we are together. And John, thank you for being the person who made it possible for me to be with you here today. And just briefly to share with you a United Nations perspective on where we stand at the moment, and also why the Bamako conference, that's the focus of our attention right now, was really a very important conference indeed. If we go back a year to November last year, we'd come together in Geneva, governments and international agencies, to discuss the strategy for dealing with avian and human influenza issues. And the strategy has five parts to it. The first is to really push out hard on improving animal health. The second is to concentrate on scaling up human health services and getting ready to implement these international health regulations. The third is to prepare for the impact of pandemic on economic life and on governance and security, something that could be extremely important were the next pandemic to be as severe as some suggest it might be. The fourth is to mobilize societies so that they understand that the issues that we're discussing are real and are not science fiction. And fifthly, to build solidarity across the world, because if we're asking countries globally to get investing in preventing avian influenza becoming more widespread or in preparing for a pandemic, we're asking them to spend quite a lot of money. And the United States government, I'll be straight here, has been a very important leader in this work. From the president with his statements at the General Assembly in September last year, and then the launch of the International Partnership on Avian and Pandemic Influenza, and its first meeting in October. 1 year on, what kind of action have we seen? What's gone on? Well, as John just said, we had a year with an awful lot of avian influenza in it. The virus moved dramatically across the world, many countries affected, and we had a year in which human cases of avian influenza increased. Small numbers, but they increased relentlessly. And so we were dealing with an ongoing threat that's still there and still very much a cause of concern. But we saw an incredible mobilization of global political energy during the last year. Governments the world over investing in building up their animal health services and trying to get their public health services working better as well. Strong alliances, not just between health and agriculture, but between private and public sector, involving, as we heard, non-governmental organizations as well, coming into place quickly, much more quickly on this issue than we had, for example, on HIV/AIDS. Perhaps we've learned a lot from the HIV/AIDS experience. We saw countries moving quickly to build up their capacity to respond to avian influenza outbreaks and to be ready for a pandemic. And management systems come into place with operation centres, not only in national headquarters, but also sometimes at state level, and governments, led often by the head of state, looking regularly at the statistics so that they could plan their responses. We saw intense social mobilization with public service announcements going out on television and radio, and mass mobilization of people around the threats posed by avian influenza, and the beginnings, and I'm afraid only the beginnings, of strong compensation programs for people whose livelihoods were affected by these problems. But I'm afraid we've still got a long way to go. And the Bamako conference showed us just how profoundly
Thank you, Steve. Delighted to be here again at CSIS on this important topic. And I think maybe the best way I could use my time here today is not to give you a whole set of facts and statistics about what the United States is doing. Maybe just say a couple of things to kind of set the parameters for this, but I want to focus really on some observations about where we are right now. USAID is just one part of the USG response. We have commitments of $191 million that involve 53 countries. Part of that response, by the way, is to support the work of David Nabarro, WHO, FAO, OIE. That total, for example, within that larger amount I gave you was $37 million. $23 million of that is the Food and Agricultural Association. We have always considered that our support and collaboration with the international organizations to be a key component of what the USG does. In terms of our general strategy, without going into details about how we do it, the point is we have to work abroad on preventing the pandemic from developing and from spreading to the United States. That means a lot of work with animals. It has to do with outbreak response. It has to do with the commodity stockpiles of personal protective equipment. We have 1.5 million on order or being sent out or put in warehouses, et cetera. We do a lot on communications. We do a lot of help to countries to develop their strategic plans. We train, along with HHS and USDA, personnel who are involved in some way in dealing with this. All of those are the strategies we use, and I'm not going to go into more detail than that here. But let me make four observations about where we are right now in light of what happened in Mali a few days ago. The first point is I think Bamako was important for three reasons. I think it was important because it was important for Africa. It was important that we were in Africa. It was big news there. It helped get it on the agenda for Africa. And this is important because Africa, as we will hear a little bit later, is an exceptionally vulnerable part of the world if the pandemic really does take off. So that was an important outcome of the Bamako conference. As Ambassador Lang said, the commitment of an additional $475 million, and it will be a little bit more when all the pledges come in, is a lot of money, and it's going to help. And as David just said, this is a very important to continue our focus. I couldn't agree more with him about the need to maintain our focus. It was also important because it was once again an opportunity for collaboration. A lot of times the meetings that go on outside of the official meetings between even U.S. government agencies who see each other sometimes more abroad than we do here in Washington, our relationships with our international organizations, with the affected countries, all of those meetings really helped to solidify the degree to which this has to be a cooperative effort. So I would say my first point is that Bamako really was important for those reasons. And yet, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't go on to say that there was something else we noticed at Bamako in comparison to what we saw in Beijing, for those of us who were in Beijing early in the year. There is something which I would call basically issue fatigue that's beginning to be more manifest throughout the world, and that's quite natural. Even though the number of new countries who were exposed to H5N1 grew by 41 in 2006, and yet the pandemic hasn't occurred yet, and it's only natural for people to wonder if this is basically a question of the international community calling wolf one too many times, and this whole thing is just not going to materialize. And you sense that in a certain difference in the intensity level, the amount of press coverage. Thankfully, it didn't get reflected in the donors. The donors seemed to understand, as David Nabarro said, the importance of continuing to be involved. But my prediction would be, unless there's a lot that happens during the flu season this year, you would expect that issue fatigue to grow stronger during this year, be more manifest in New Delhi at the end of next year. My third point, despite that, we've got to understand that this is not primarily about just H5N1. And this maybe is the most important thing I have to say today. John Barry, in his book about the great influenza of 1918, talks about 10 pandemics in 300 years. Some of them are not as extensive as the one in 1918 was. But as Ambassador Lang pointed out, if we had one like 1918 with today's populations and vulnerabilities, it would be a big deal. It would be very, very serious indeed. But this is what we have to keep emphasizing. All the work that we are doing now is not wasted effort if the H5N1 isn't the big one. Because if it's not H5N1, 3 years or 2 years or 5 years, it will be something else. All of the efforts that are underway now have to do with the relationship between animals and human beings. And until that relationship is tightened up in terms of biosecurity, et cetera, we're always vulnerable. So the threat is not primarily just H5N1. It's our relationship with animals, and that's a very key point. And my fourth and final point has to do with Africa. I think if you look at the density of human beings relative to the bird population in Africa, compare it with Southeast Asia, the odds do not favor this being where it's actually going to break out. Most experts continue to believe that Indonesia or someplace in Southeast Asia, where the intensity of population contact with birds in situations in the islands of Indonesia, for example, is such that if it's going to change, you've got a lot more chances of it happening there. If it's going to mutate, it may happen there. But here's the point. It may not break out in Africa, but whenever it breaks out in Southeast Asia or anywhere it goes, and when it goes to Africa, there's no place on the planet that's as vulnerable as Africa is. The health systems are terrible compared to the rest of the world. You have food security issues and water issues. If somebody gets the flu, let alone a pandemic version of the flu, and they've got problems with water and infectious disease and lack of food, lack of nutrition, they are much more vulnerable to what will happen as a result of the pandemic hitting. And that brings me to my final point on this fourth point, which is simply this. I think now, and I think that David can help us lead this charge on this point, we're going to need to be doing some contingency planning for humanitarian assistance to Africa. We've tended to talk about all the ways we prevent the pandemic from perhaps occurring and taking place and dealing with the relationship between animals and people. We probably haven't spent as much time, and maybe didn't spend as much time in Bamako as we should have, on thinking about what do we do now to prepare for how we would respond to a humanitarian crisis in Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. DeHay.
Thank you, Steve. And I, too, want to thank CSIS for the opportunity to be here and talk about this particular issue and situation from a decidedly animal health perspective. I come from the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service within the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where we are the primary animal health and plant health regulatory agency within the department. The reason that we are so concerned about this particular virus is because of the numbers of countries that have been affected continues to increase, the number of cases in birds and people continues to increase, and while the ongoing risk of a potential human pandemic continues, let's not lose sight of the fact that there are significant costs and human suffering that are ongoing just because of the impact of this virus, even if it doesn't become a pandemic. I should also add, coming from the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, that while the focus today is clearly international, that there has been a lot done, and that work continues within the Department of Agriculture domestically to prepare for the potential arrival of this virus into the United States. We have a three-part strategy in terms of exclusion, keeping the virus out of our country through appropriate restrictions on importation of poultry and poultry products, as well as bolstered efforts at our border, early detection through extensive surveillance in all of the relevant bird populations, and then rapid response if we should detect the virus. But looking globally at this particular virus and the threat that it represents, there's already been some 220 million birds that have either died or been culled because of exposure to the virus. needless to say, with that kind of impact, the economic consequences are huge. With the loss of an important food source in developing countries, as well as disruption of domestic and international markets in developed countries that have found the virus. But I think it's very important that we emphasize every opportunity we get that this is very much still a disease in animals. The ongoing spread of the disease in affected countries and the new outbreaks in additional countries are an expression of the lack of veterinary infrastructure. In contrast, when outbreaks have occurred in developed countries with a good veterinary infrastructure, the virus has been found quickly and eliminated quickly. So arguably, the most important thing that we can do to, one, reduce the risk of a pandemic, and two, to prevent the spread of the existing virus to the United States, is to help those countries that are currently affected with this virus. Just to summarize some of the activities that have been ongoing within the United States Department of Agriculture, we in fact have been tracking the virus since it was first found in Hong Kong in 1997. The initial funding for the animal health side came from a redirection of some of the tsunami relief funds in September of 2005. We activated our APHIS Emergency Operations Center in March of 2006, both to do preparation from a domestic and an international perspective. And we formed a interagency coordination group for our international activities with our sister agency, the Foreign Agricultural Service, within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. You've heard mentioned several times already with the alliances that we have with the multinational agencies, specifically the OIE, the World Organization for Animal Health, and the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization within the UN. The OIE has developed an assessment tool to assess a country's veterinary infrastructure, and so they are using that tool to assess countries' infrastructure and their ability to deal with this virus, with the intention of doing 15 of those assessments by the end of March of next year. Once those assessments are done, then that material, that information, would be transferred to the FAO, who would take those assessments and get the necessary resources, expertise, and equipment to the countries to meet the needs identified in those OIE assessments. We're working with the FAO to build their emergency response capability through the creation of a crisis management center to provide for that initial coordinated rapid response from an animal health perspective. And indeed, one of the limiting factors is not so much financial resources, but human resources, the expertise to help countries address the problem in their respective borders. So we're working with the FAO to develop a roster of global experts that are willing to go into these countries and provide the necessary expertise, whether it be an emergency response or epidemiology, tracking the disease, or compensation programs to compensate farmers who may be suffering losses from those programs. We've been involved in a lot of training, providing technical expertise and equipment for laboratories and diagnostics, again, veterinary epidemiology, training folks to be able to find the source of disease and where it might have spread within their country. Biosecurity at live bird markets, recognizing in many of these cultures, live bird markets are the primary source of poultry and indeed a perfect way to spread disease, so good biosecurity at those live bird markets. And again, farmer compensation, recognizing that if you want voluntary cooperation and participation in a country's program to control or eradicate the disease, farmers have to be adequately compensated for the losses from the destruction of infected or exposed birds. We're also doing a lot of wild bird surveillance, not just in the United States, but we're assisting countries like Canada, China, Greenland, and Mexico, and even Russia, to do wild bird surveillance, recognizing that wild birds are not only the reservoir, but potentially one of the pathways for spread of the disease. We've learned a number of lessons so far, again, from a decidedly animal health perspective. First of all, countries need an incentive to carry out surveillance and to detect this H5N1 highly pathogenic virus. The OIE code, the code that regulates and provides a standard for the movement of poultry and poultry products, provides for safe trade in poultry and poultry products, even from countries that are affected by this virus, assuming appropriate safeguards in place. And we're working with developing countries that have no export markets, But again, having farmer compensation in place to encourage voluntary participation in those programs. Second, H5N1 is a global crisis that requires consistent and coordinated approach. The UN agency, specifically FAO, the WHO, and UNICEF, as well as the OIE, have a key leadership and coordination role. And we think that these international agencies play a key role in coordinating efforts so that we ensure effective and efficient use of the resources that are made available. Third, regional partnerships are important, so we need to work through regional organizations such as the African Union and some of the regional and sub-regional offices of the FAO and OIE, recognizing that each country needs a program on the ground, but regional coordination and regional assistance can provide great assistance in carrying out those country-by-country programs. Fourth, within the United States government, consistent attention is needed, continual attention is needed for our interagency effort to ensure that Department of State, Health and Human Services, USAID, and USDA have a coordinated approach. The Department of State does, in fact, have a coordinating role, and Ambassador Lang is doing a terrific job in ensuring that our efforts are coordinated, not duplicative, and that we don't have gaps. And finally, assistance to developing countries should stress long-term capacity building and benefits, not just short-term emergency response measures. The significant donations that have been made available through the international community because of H5N1 create a unique opportunity to help developing countries build that essential animal health infrastructure. We can anticipate that with increased global trade, with the increased movement of people internationally, that we're going to have a greater frequency of emerging zoonotic diseases. And as been mentioned, the better that we prepare countries to respond to the H5N1 virus, the better prepared they will be when the next emerging zoonotic disease comes along. And finally, some specific comments relative to the Bamako conference, again, from an animal health perspective. The existing conditions in Africa, such as drought, political conflict, HIV, AIDS, malaria, and poverty, make those countries more vulnerable to rapid spread of this highly pathogenic virus. Inadequate policies and veterinary infrastructure have resulted in several countries now facing an endemic situation where the disease has become well established within the country, as we've seen elsewhere in other countries such as Indonesia. Third, simple communication strategies that have worked well in Asia may not work so well in Africa due to cultural and economic constraints. Simple things like separation of children from birds and ensuring that the resources that are provided actually go for their intended use. But at the same time, we have seen in countries like Vietnam and Thailand that political commitment coupled with a good animal health and human health infrastructure can indeed eliminate the virus. So finally, I just want to emphasize what my colleagues have already said. This is a long-term effort, and we're going to have to work very hard to maintain the global momentum that we currently enjoy to see this through to the appropriate end. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. De Haven. I'd like to offer just a couple of brief comments and put two questions forward. I think it's a very apt moment for us to be taking account and trying to look forward. This mobilization, as Kent has emphasized, it's global, it cuts across animal and human populations, and it's one that is very much centered on preparedness, and sustaining international response is intrinsically a difficult enduring challenge that we will be having to work continually into the future. It's also this mobilization. It's an interesting coalition. It's a new kind of coalition that's formed up. And that brings me to my first question, which really has to do with the way in which we might begin to better leverage the intersection of Chinese and American interest and African interest in these issues. This was your first international gathering in Africa, coming out of the Beijing and subsequent Vienna sessions. It's coming shortly after the rollout of the China-Africa Strategic Partnership in Beijing in early November, in which global health issues, were public health issues figured in that. It's coming at a time when Margaret Chan is entering WHO leadership position. It's coming in a period in which the U.S. health stakes, health equities within Africa have risen dramatically. HIV/AIDS, we just had the malaria summit that President Bush hosted this past week. So the question there is, how might, as a matter of sustaining the interest levels and addressing the particular challenges that you see in Africa that you were discussing in Bamako, how could the United States and China better leverage those intersecting interests around public health and the degree to which you could argue that each has deep interests on the pandemic influenza and rising stakes in Africa overall? The second question has to do with Nigeria. You identified Nigeria as one of the three most troubling concerns, countries in the mix, along with Egypt and Indonesia. And I know, John, you and your delegation had a chance to visit Nigeria. I was hoping you could offer us a bit more insight into the status of efforts there. We know that Nigeria is a vast, complex, and in many parts very unsteady place. We know that it's had a difficult series of ups and downs around the international polio campaign. There's been some recent recovery of efforts under Dr. Abebe. We know that there's been a slow buildup of response on HIV/AIDS, but you now have 50,000 people on antiretroviral treatment there, we heard this morning. It's a very mixed picture, but a very daunting one, and I was hoping our speakers could speak to what we know about the threat within Nigeria and the response. John, do you want to begin?
Thank you, Steve. With regard to working with China in Africa, we did have discussions with the Chinese, and we haven't formulated any specific elements of cooperation thus far. But certainly, given their focus on this issue, this, as we discussed earlier, really began in Southeast Asia, and there is a very heightened level of awareness in China and many other countries in that region of this. They did host the seminal conference in terms of pledging, the first pledging conference in Beijing in January. There is that very strong interest on their part in this. We've met with their delegations, and but we haven't yet come up with something specific regarding Africa. And in Africa, I think what really we'll look back on the Bamako conference of 10 days ago really to see that this set the stage for new levels of cooperation that are still just yet to be formulated at this point. With regard to Nigeria, we did have several people from who went on from Bamako to Nigeria, and on our delegation, Dr. Dennis Carroll from the U.S. Agency for International Development, and a veterinarian, Joe Anelli from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and others went with me to Nigeria. And we had been impressed in Bamako by the presentation by the Chief Veterinary Officer of Nigeria, Dr. Mina, and he impressed us in the same way, I would say, in Abuja, in terms of he really understands the difficulties of this and the need to act quickly. We were able to arrange, while we were in Nigeria, a visit to Kaduna State and met with their the state-level avian influenza control effort, the committee, and even went to a farm there which had employed some biosecurity measures. There was an interesting comment by the farmer when we visited this large-scale poultry farm, and this is his phrase, not mine. The the outbreak of avian influenza in Nigeria that first began in February was a blessing in disguise. And what he meant by that was it was a wake-up call on the need for the biosecurity measures that you heard Dr. DeHaven and others talk about, that we really do have to change the animal husbandry practices in many parts of the world if we're going to be able to benefit the human health side by preventing or at least minimizing the opportunities for these animal diseases to cross over into the human health sector. And so it was really quite enlightening. But at the same time, there are huge challenges in Nigeria, as you point out, Steve, and the central one in many respects is the implementation. The good ideas that the Chief Veterinary Officer and the Ministry of Health and others have at the federal level need to be translated to the state level and then to the local government areas. And that clearly is a challenge in a decentralized country such as Nigeria. It's been a challenge that we've seen in other countries that have federal systems. It's one which is a daunting task, and while they have the proper directions from the top, in terms of the interests at the highest levels of the Ministry of Health, Ministry of Agriculture, and the President was deeply engaged initially. He had his crisis management center operating right out of his own office when this first occurred. The idea of sustaining this and implementing this is not at all easy there.
Thank you. David, would you care to offer any remarks around, particularly around leveraging the China stakes and the American stakes?
So there are always going to be two parts to the response to the threats posed by pandemics. And I'd like to start, obviously, with influenza. But remember, we're also dealing with another pandemic as well, profoundly in Africa, which is HIV. And there will be more pandemics in the future, many of which may be derived from animals. The first is you've got to have the state doing its job. You can't address this kind of issue without a government that has the capacity to track what is happening in regard to pathogens and looking at changes in those pathogens over time and assessing the threats and then responding to those threats. And perhaps the most interesting lesson for me is Thailand, which has always had a strong government response capacity and was able to bring this up to speed very quickly a couple of years ago when they started to get avian influenza problems. But the second part is people themselves have got to be engaged. There's no way of addressing any of these major issues without full popular engagement. What have I sensed has been happening in China, Stephen? Well, I think, firstly, government has had to step up its own response capacities quite rapidly and with a great deal of energy, building on SARS experience. But also there's been a very big program of consciousness raising with the general public, and that in turn has led to a much wider understanding of some of the issues that are being faced in China. And I'd like to see the same energy perhaps being introduced into some of the other countries in other parts of the world which are facing these threats. And not only do I want to see investment in government capacity, but also in raising awareness among the general public through massive communications campaigns, plus incentives for people to improve the biosecurity with which they're caring for their animals. And I sense that there will be dialogue of that kind underway between Chinese professionals and African professionals in the new environment with Margaret Chan as Director General of WHO, using the international health regulations that John Lang just mentioned as an overarch. But we, all of us may need to be perhaps on the sidelines encouraging that kind of dialogue and that kind of process to move forward, because it's in all of our collective interests that those two sides, the public campaigning and the government systems, are moved forward. So watch this space. Why don't we look again in a couple of years' time and see whether or not we have got evidence of improvements in both these areas.
Thank you. Kent, did you have anything you want to add?
I appreciated the thrust of the first part of your question because you asked about the broader development questions as the way to get at dealing with the issue in Africa. And I think you're right to point to what the President said last week when he indicated that during his time in the White House, assistance to Africa has doubled. And he went on to commit that to the best of his ability, he would see that, he would like to see that doubled again by the end of the decade. And that's very, very important. It's not without its irony that Ambassador Tobias, who's the Director of U.S. Foreign Assistance and the head of USAID right now, sits in the office in the State Department, his State Department office, which is the old office of George C. Marshall. And it's only under President Kennedy that you saw that you've seen the kind of increase in foreign assistance that we've seen recently. Now, that's critical for avian influenza as well, because if we don't deal with these chronic problems of health infrastructure and, as Ron was saying, the veterinary infrastructure, we're simply not going to be prepared for what's ahead. Now, it's true, to the second part of your question, that in terms of Nigeria or Egypt or the other six countries that have infections right now, that the amounts of money are really quite modest. The four parts of the world, Africa would be the third in terms of the size. Most of the money has gone to Southeast Asia. Europe and Eurasia, Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union have received the second amount. $35 million has been committed or pledged to be spent this year in Africa. And although that will go up some, I don't think anybody is proposing that we shouldn't continue to spend a lot of money in Southeast Asia. So there's going to be a minimal amount of money available to do as much as we would like to do in Africa, but it's got to always be in a context that is much, much broader than just thinking about H5N1.
Ron, did you have any?
Just one quick comment to emphasize a couple of points that have been made. One, I think that if we don't take advantage of the current H5N1 situation from a veterinary infrastructure perspective, we're missing a really, really unique opportunity. Whether this becomes a pandemic or not, there will be a pandemic. And again, to the extent that we can help countries of Africa, some of the Southeast Asian countries, build infrastructure through the resources and the energy made available because of H5N1, we need to do so while we still have that momentum going. The second point is, indeed, the programs that we're trying to develop have to be carried out on the ground. So while we do need global coordination through the multinational organizations and UN organizations such as the FAO, in fact, ultimately you need a program at the ground level, at the community level. So we need to work with countries. We need to make sure that they have programs within their states or districts, as the case may be, and that those programs are tailored to work within the existing framework that's there. What is the industry? What is the veterinary or lack of veterinary infrastructure to deal with? And then come up with an appropriate strategy that works on the ground at the level of the community.
Thank you. We have an opportunity now to field questions. What I'd like to do, Laurie, can we start with you? We have microphones. Please introduce yourselves. What I'd like to do is I think there are three hands up. If I could take three questions quickly in sequence, please identify yourselves, and then we'll come back to our speakers. Laurie?
Hi, I'm Laurie Garrett from the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to thank you, Steve, for pulling this together. It's very timely and very, very helpful. I have four, but really, really quick, and I'll just say them and pass it on. First, since we have increasing evidence that Tamiflu is a very dangerous drug in a number of ways, but most policies, including ours, rest heavily on Tamiflu and oseltamivir, what changes are occurring, if any, was that discussed in Bamako? Second, since we still don't know the answer in terms of the cytokine storm effect of H5N1 exposure to the human body, what exactly will happen with a person with a beleaguered immune system, therefore HIV positive? Did that come up? Do we have any real answers from the African perspective of what it means to have a mass population of HIV positive? Is that a plus or a minus in terms of exposure to H5N1? The data certainly would seem to be mixed on that. And third, Ron, what do you make of the J Virology study showing the joint Russia-America study on the Siberian ice melt and the release of ancient influenza viruses into migrating bird populations? And that would be it for me.
Thank you, Laurie. back here and then over here.
Robert Daguilar, Voice of America. Yes, Robert Daguilar, Voice of America. According to the criteria you listed, certainly the Great Lakes region of Africa, with its succession of horrific crises, instances of civil conflict, and all that, would seem to qualify as having some of the criteria that contribute to the spread of H5N1. That if in fact it were to come to this, perhaps our panelists could each in turn summarize the extent to which they see the Great Lakes region as being at risk for the development of a pandemic or the transmission of a pandemic, and certainly the extent and the way in which the administration on one hand and the UN system in the other are assisting the countries of the region in preparing for what could become a pandemic.
Thank you. And we have a third questioner here. Please identify yourself.
Jeff Burnham in the Africa Bureau of State. I had a question possibly for Dr. DeHaven. How important are these compensation schemes in getting farmers to prevent the spread of avian influenza? And if they are important, where's the money for them coming from?
Thank you very much. John, do you want to start off on any of these? Or Dr. Nabarro, do you want to some of the technical questions Lori was raising, and maybe you want to handle some of those first, please.
Thank you very much indeed. The place of oseltamivir, or Tamiflu, in pandemic preparedness was not the subject for major discussion in Bamako. It has, however, been talked about quite a lot in other settings in the recent past, as many of you would know, including some here in Washington. And I think that it's fair to say that despite some of the dangers that have been reported, that still the majority of pandemic containment plans do envisage an important role for antiviral drugs of the oseltamivir family, the neuraminidase inhibitors, along with a number of other interventions which include social distancing. Now, despite the fact that this wasn't itself a major point of discussion in Bamako, one of the undercurrents that was in Bamako that I'd like to share with you was that there is concern on the part of many African countries that they just do not have the level of resources that is available to countries like this, like the United States. And so when it comes to them preparing for pandemic, they have to approach it in rather a different way from the way in which more wealthy countries are approaching it. And there were certainly several requests to me and to the United Nations system more broadly that we do give some attention to how poor countries with very low gross national product can prepare adequately for their people to survive under pandemic conditions. There was a brief discussion on the potential impact of HIV positivity and immune deficiency on the progression of avian influenza in humans, actually from the Indonesian delegation. This was given a relatively small amount of attention because I fear that we do not have answers, plus or minus, as to what immune deficiency, particularly as a result of HIV, will do for the progression of avian influenza or a possible pandemic. One or two of the other points, Robert from Voice of America, let's just be a bit clear on this. I think that there was recognition that it's perhaps not going to be in Africa that it's most likely that the mutation to lead to the pandemic virus will actually happen. Most observers reckon that it's places with very high density of a bird virus are the ones where the pandemic mutation is most likely. So I think there's still a general view that the concentration of H5N1, at least, is greatest in the endemic countries of Asia and perhaps in one or two locations, including one in the Middle East, where there is a rather high concentration of virus in a very small geographical area. But I think the issue that many of us were focusing on was that if a pandemic virus reaches Africa, perhaps coming by plane or overland or by sea from another location outside Africa, because of the, as Kent just said, the relative weakness of the social systems and the health systems in many African nations, the consequences could be quite horrific. And I think that that was an underpinning sensation in many of the comments of people in the conference who were talking about what will happen if and when pandemic influenza hits sub-Saharan Africa or even the broader African continent that was our focus. And yes, countries are asking us to help them to look at these issues, not just over the next few weeks and months, but on a much longer term basis. They're reeling from the impact of HIV, and they don't want to be hit by another major health crisis in the near future and not be prepared for it. I think that those are my quick reactions to two out of the three questions.
David, can I just follow up, and we'll move to the compensation scheme question and ask Ron to comment on that. On this broad question of how do you motivate African governments to take this issue up more seriously than has been the case up to now? I mean, one issue clearly is the rather paltry resource levels that have been put on the table up to now. And the question there is there any shift of thinking or strategy within this broad coalition that is driving these substantial new pledges to give greater priority to supporting investments in preparedness and response and monitoring and surveillance within Africa? And related to that is when you have countries that are very wealthy, at least in terms of oil revenue streams, like Nigeria, vast countries, vast populations, vast poverty, weak institutions, but huge inflows of dollars right now, and a history where when they have paid very large reputational prices for falling down on the polio campaign, have at least been sensitive and responsive to trying to correct course. How do you persuade a Nigeria with all other things that are going on to take this issue up more seriously? You've identified it as one of your core problem areas. Money is not the issue. It's political will and capacity and priority in among the multitude of other dire pressures that are at play right now within Nigeria.
Is that an easy question directed at me, Stephen?
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, it's interesting how you started out saying money is not the problem.
With Nigeria.
Yet there was a period in February this year when the location of easily available cash in order to initiate the responses at the state level was a pretty difficult problem for the Nigerians, and they needed outside help. And that's simply because institutionally, to turn from having a problem to then having the cash, the systems, the people, even the fuel to respond to that problem is quite tricky. And that's where the outside world has to provide a kind of buffer in order to help get those institutions going. They're not easily able to produce the kind of money and the capacities that are needed as quickly as we might hope. And I want to stress that the political will in Nigeria has been incredibly strong. The president set up the crisis management team, bringing together key parts of government within days in the presidential palace. And I went there and observed it all kind of happening, and it was very dramatic. I would not fault Nigeria or indeed Egypt or other affected countries on political will. But the challenge is always to convert that into the capacity of institutions to perform the functions that we know that are necessary. And there is only one way of doing this, which is through solidarity, that we have to work together in partnership. external groups like, for example, U.S. Agency for International Development, often working through the U.S. mission in the country, and of course the UN system, my organization, and we do it in partnership together, supporting each other, often through quite a difficult early few weeks and months of the operation to get it right. But I wouldn't want anybody to walk away from here saying there wasn't the political will. I wouldn't want people to walk away saying there aren't the capacities, but it's converting the existing capacities and the political will into institutions that work and systems that deliver. And we do that using the time-honored system of working together on the same issues. Now, these guys have just been in Nigeria, so they probably would like to answer more directly.
In my meeting with the Minister of Agriculture and high-level officials in the Ministry of Health, it's clear that they're engaged on this, and as David pointed out, the President has been engaged. But in some respects, first of all, one has to be very clear, and are we talking about avian influenza and the outbreaks among poultry populations, or are we talking about pandemic preparedness, planning, and all that on the human side? And those are very distinct issues. There was such an immediacy to the situation in Nigeria when the outbreaks occurred, and I remember having a conversation in Kaduna State with a woman who used to have 1,000 chickens on her farm. Now she's down to 500. They couldn't even sell chickens there for a period. There's a country in East Asia that just in the last few weeks encountered a very small outbreak, quickly contained, and still poultry prices went down by 20%. This has such an immediate impact, and those who are affected by this, especially the commercial poultry producers, but it trickles down to the backyard farmers, have their own incentives to act and to take this seriously. In terms of the pandemic planning, which is an issue, of course, that all countries face, no matter where this pandemic begins, it will, if it cannot be contained initially, it is undoubtedly going to spread around the world, and then it'll be in the Great Lakes region, and it'll be in Nigeria, and it'll be in this country. And countries can take measures to slow the progress, there is some effort in the U.S. government right now to look at community containment modeling, and that is something that is being looked at on the domestic side, and the lessons that we learn and glean from past experiences, we're going to be discussing that internationally. But on the whole, it is very difficult for some countries when they are faced with so many daunting challenges, and HIV is one of them, to then devote a large amount of resources to something that may or may not happen. So countries are engaged. If you look back at the progress that's been made in the last year, I believe it was 40 countries in the world had pandemic preparedness plans as of November 2005, and now it's over 175 countries. Some are obviously more detailed than others, but there has been this effort. There is more engagement on the part of countries, just that much more needs to be done.
Thank you. Dr. DeHaven, could you speak to the issue on the farmer compensation scheme?
Thanks, Steve. I'd be glad to. One of the key principles to containing and eradicating a disease outbreak is early detection and then, of course, rapid response. Speaking in the context of the U.S. situation, we would contemplate that kind of response in a matter of hours, not days or weeks, as we are seeing in some countries around the world. But the same principles apply whether you're talking about identifying a new introduction into a country or controlling the spread of the disease in a country that's already affected. You have to have early detection of the disease so that you can respond quickly and contain the spread of the disease. We think that fair compensation for those producers who are going to be affected by such a program is an essential component of any program. If a farmer doesn't feel like he or she is going to be compensated for their loss, then the tendency is going to be to not report it, to glean whatever value the animals may have either on the supper table that night or in local markets to avoid losing that source of protein and that potential source of revenue. Compensation has always been a part of our eradication and control programs within the Department of Agriculture, and we've had several incursions of foreign animal disease that we've successfully contained and eradicated and have provided fair market value for the animals that we required to be destroyed. So I think a couple key components of any compensation program, one is that it has to be paid promptly, particularly in developing countries. If that compensation isn't paid quickly, here again, there will be a tendency not to report. And second, it needs to be based on fair market value, but not too fair. There have been some situations where the compensation paid for animals that were destroyed actually exceeded what the producer thought they were worth, and so there was an incentive to find the disease and become infected. So there's a fine line there, and in fact, some compensation schemes would compensate at somewhere between 75% and 90% of what is determined to be the fair market value. We should point out that the World Bank did, in fact, do a study on compensation programs around the world. This report was released at the Bamako conference and made some strong recommendations on compensation programs while also taking a look at the existing programs around the world. So I think that is a hugely useful resource that can be applied in a number of situations, and I think one where we need more in-depth discussion within the international community as we work to develop those compensation programs. As far as sources of the funding, I think they're multiple. I would let Dr. Nabarro speak to that because I believe that the World Bank has indicated that they are willing to fund compensation schemes to the extent that they're consistent with these guiding principles.
Thank you. Kent, did you have anything you want to add?
Maybe I'll just add a couple things. Laurie, you were asking the question about Tamiflu, and by extension, let me just say this is a great opportunity to make the case that internationally the whole focus, the whole strategy hasn't been on treatment and or even a vaccine. Not that those aren't important elements, but we have decided that abroad the most effective thing we can do is try to prevent this from taking place at all, because I think there's a recognition really throughout that if this does break out, if it does resort, nobody really has that much faith in any medicine that now exists to think that it can really get this cat back in the bag. So that's why the focus has been, at least internationally, elsewhere. We spend a lot of money domestically on these issues, but we haven't and probably shouldn't there. With respect to your question on HIV and the vulnerabilities, I would just make the broader point that regardless of some of the conflicting information on HIV, there doesn't seem to be much doubt that the whole weakened environment because of infectious diseases there with respect, and if you add to that water problems and nutrition problems, I don't think there's any question that that makes people more vulnerable to whatever hits them that's dangerous from a health standpoint. Our colleague from Africa mentioned the question of the Great Lakes and whether there might be some more vulnerability there. I think the one of the points that could be made here that hasn't been made yet today is that to the extent it does make sense to look at migration patterns, see where the birds are coming from Eastern Europe or wherever they're coming from, and expect that it's possible that it could transmit that way. But one of the surprises that caught many experts off guard was that, in fact, we think that in Africa, a lot of the initial spread occurred in places we didn't predict. And so it was because of illegal trade. This is true in Southeast Asia. It's true in Africa. It's one of those thorny political issues, one of the issues that probably ought to be teed up for ministerial-level discussions at future meetings is how do you deal with international illegal trade, which seems to be, as much as migration, maybe a huge factor in what happens here. And maybe one final point on money not being necessarily the way to just attack this with lots of money, whether it's compensation or otherwise. Ron's done a great job in pointing out that this is a tricky business in compensation. It can actually have the wrong incentives in place. But another issue, of course, is absorptive capacity. You have to ask yourself the question, what can we do with any amount of money in a particular area? And it's not just it's not as simple as saying how much money can we collect to use here. It's a question of how much can they effectively absorb to make a difference.
Thank you. We have a few more minutes, so I'd like to invite another round of comments. We have two, three. If we could start with this gentleman right here in the front and just work our way around. Please identify yourself, and please keep your intervention brief. Thank you.
I'm Kyle Kenner. I work for CARE US. I'd like to invite the panelists to talk about the necessary funding for U.S. interventions in the year ahead. It's obviously going to be a tough budget year for all of your agencies. The commitment at Bamako is important, but it strikes me that it would be advisable that be with new money and that not come as an expense, for example, of other core poverty-fighting foreign assistance accounts. And so part of the challenge is transmitting the urgency that we're hearing today to policymakers on the Hill. And it's not entirely clear to me that they yet share your urgency. For example, the recent passage of the bioterrorism bill, CARE submitted formal comments urging that there be an international preparedness title included in that bill. There was not. And I think to some extent that reflects the sense that domestic investments are more critical than international preparedness. We disagree, and it sounds like you may as well, but I think policymakers need to hear that more emphatically than they do now. And so what I guess I would do is urge members of the government to use your budget submission to transmit that urgency. Use both the president's budget and your budget in brief to tell the Congress how important this is, and also consider an amendment in the SUP. If we're going to do a big SUP anyway, it may be that international preparedness, that this is the opportune moment to make those investments, because we've made serious investments on the domestic side, but I think we're ready to do the international side. Thank you.
Steve Wilbur, thank you very much. I work for John Snow Incorporated in the Deliver Logistics Project, and I just spent the last 5 years working in Uganda with the development and improvement of logistics systems. My question is, was there any discussion in Bamako about within-country distribution of commodities? Was there any discussion of logistics issues that came up? I think this will be very critical to provide the quick response.
Thank you. Peter O'Driscoll from ActionAid International. Dr. Navarro put emphasis not only on the role of the state in addressing the situation, but also the need to mobilize and engage the population. And I'm wondering if the Bamako conference made any assessment or reference to the potential or current role of NGOs in complementing the effort of the state in the education and mobilizational efforts, especially with particularly vulnerable populations and women.
Thank you. Why don't we start, John, if you could take on the
There is a series of supplemental appropriations that have been passed, and I'll actually ask Kent Hill to describe a bit about the USAID budget status that have provided money for this. From the State Department perspective, where my office is based, we have a small amount. It's $6 million that includes our own operating expenses, which support the international partnership, but also our public diplomacy and public affairs outreach efforts, which we're cooperating with our embassies around the world, training journalists and raising awareness on this. For the larger sums in terms of assistance, that's really through Health and Human Services, USAID and USDA, and to a lesser extent through the Department of Defense. There is some funding that has been requested for the fiscal year 2007 that is has not yet been appropriated, and as you know, we're on a continuing resolution at this point. So that has been made clear, and I wouldn't want to speculate at this point about a inclusion in a supplemental. That will be for further discussion within the administration. If I could just mention a comment on the last question on the role of NGOs, the big representation from the NGOs was by the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. They had a lengthy statement that they made at the conference. They've been very much, as you know, historically been involved in preparedness planning, and that's certainly a major element then of what this is all about when you look at the pandemic side of the equation. They were active also at the conference in Vienna, and we have been dealing with them and with other NGOs on this. So it was an important element to bring into the discussions. It wasn't a lengthy discussion, I have to say, about the role of NGOs, but I think everyone clearly recognizes the import of that. And when you look at the whole issue of playing out a possible pandemic, and if it's anything close to being as severe as the 1918 pandemic, the scenarios become so mind-bogglingly complex. It's really amazing when we try to think this through, whether it's the logistics and transportation issues, whether it's disruptions that can occur to freight transport when you have a country that deals or companies that deal in just-in-time manufacturing, when you deal with the complications that will take place with disruptions to commerce. There are though some people say, well, everybody can just telework, they can work from home. But there are some people who say that in the height of a pandemic, some estimate that you could have 30% to 40% of the workforce out. Some people would be sick themselves, others would be caring for the sick, and others would be afraid to go out. Well, that means 30% to 40% of the people who maintain the servers for the internet also. So it may not be so simple to just work from home. So that when you look at the logistics and all of these issues, they become very, very complex the more one fleshes out one's pandemic preparedness plan.
Thank you. David? Logistics issue.
Thank you very much indeed. Imagine five circles on a kind of big diagram: animal health, human health, pandemic preparedness, mobilization of communities, and then the financial and other support that's necessary for all these things to happen. These are the areas in which we're all working, and it's not an easy set of issues to be able to handle simultaneously. If you kind of look inside USAID, you see a lot of different people in USAID are engaged in this issue, a lot of different parts of the US government. And so when it comes to supporting governments and communities to work on this agenda, we really do need to work together. And the role of groups outside government and civil society is absolutely critical. If we go to Vietnam together, we find that CARE US and CARE International, together with Save the Children, together with other NGOs working in countries, I'm not sure whether ActionAid's there, have been doing a lot of really excellent work at the local level to help empower and mobilize communities to act in these areas. And I think that, as John has said, but I really want to make this point, this is an issue on which PVOs or NGOs, as well as the formal machinery, as well as the international community, as well as private sector organizations, have all got to work together and play a role. And I sense that this is beginning to happen. It perhaps has taken a bit of time to come together, but the work done by the Red Cross was a statement based on a fairly intensive process of consultation that's gone on. Just like to support John, the core of the work that we're all going to have to do when the pandemic starts is logistics. It's providing a logistic base onto which weakened and stretched services will be able to build when the normal procedures and systems break down. And so we do need to spend a little bit more time, I think, talking about logistics issues, looking for John Snow, talking about logistics issues. And your colleague who was with us in Bamako, not going to embarrass with names, said to me, why haven't you talked more about logistics? So we're going to have to do that from now on.
On this issue of how do you bring across to budgeteers and policymakers the urgency that you're carrying back from this, perhaps Kent and John could comment on a little more on that question. You have a process undertaken under Ambassador Tobias's efforts to take a broad and new look at the full scope of foreign aid initiatives, of which you fall within that. How do you what's your strategy for bringing forward with greater urgency the requirements?
Well, obviously the foreign assistance reforms that are underway are designed to try to move forward an earlier discussion of a more rational, prioritized set of parameters for thinking about foreign assistance. That's what Ambassador Tobias would like to do. Supplementals are, by definition, usually something that's supposed to deal with an emergency. And the fellow from CARE was absolutely right to say, you know, when are you going to put it into your regular budget if this is going to take a number of years to work on? I think you're right to raise those kind of questions. The facts are as follows. There was a small supplemental in late 2005. There was a larger supplemental in 2006 for about $250 million that mainly went to HHS and USAID for the international component of what we were doing. There was a $55 million request, a fairly low request, for 2006, and as you know, the Congress has not yet acted upon that. Although the Congress did, we were given $30 million of that up front. So we know for sure that we have access to that $30 million. We don't know what's going to happen with the rest of the $25 million. We also don't know if there will be a further supplemental. The good thing about this issue is that it's a bipartisan issue, and there are very committed Democrats and Republicans on, you know, folks on both sides of the aisle that know how very important this is. Having said that, it's obvious there are a lot of competing priorities. I think it's dependent on us in the government and Ambassador Lange and the rest of us to try to make a case for what's the rationale for this. Explain clearly when we run out of money to respond. We had 41 countries get outbreaks this year. Even a minimal amount of money to respond, to bring the APHIS folks and HHS and USAID and the State Department there to look the situation over and respond, you know how much that costs approximately, let alone to do a response. It's our responsibility to communicate when we'll run out of money if we get 40 more countries this year or even a worse situation. We probably should use the old slogan from the TV ad about a car muffler. You can pay me now or you can pay me later. There are costs that are very, very high for not acting, and we have to make the case for that. Now, with respect to the question about logistics, I didn't hear a lot of discussion specifically in the public meetings about logistics, but I can tell you that, for example, at USAID, where we have 11 people working on avian influenza alone, I was just given a map this morning which shows all the countries in Africa and Southeast Asia, and it's got a little bar chart on each one telling me how many PPEs, personal protective equipments, are in each country, where the warehouses are going to be, and the decisions are being made now how to get that stuff out there so that if it does hit, you can move it more quickly. So there's a lot of discussion going on these kinds of issues. I know USDA, APHIS, and HHS ask similar questions, so it's important. And we're beginning to try to work on that.
Thank you. We're running towards the conclusion of this. I want to offer Dr. DeHaven a chance to say anything further. That's okay. I'd like to please thank all of our speakers on behalf of everyone here. We're very grateful. It's been very illuminating, and we hope you'll come back again soon. Thank you.